Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for June 8th, 2009, and on this week's episode, Ann Nicholson Weber interviews members from Busman's Honeymoon at the Lifeline Theater. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, and let's talk theater.
This is Ann Nicholson Weber, and you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. This week, we're talking about the adaptation of Dorothy Sayers' Busman's Honeymoon, which is currently playing at Lifeline Theater. And my guests are Francis Limoncelli, who is the adapter of the novel, and Jennifer Tyler and Peter Greenberg, who play the two main characters, Harriet Vane and Lord Peter Whimsey. Welcome to you three. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks.
Francis, could you talk a little bit about the process of adapting not only Busman's Honeymoon, but this is the third Dorothy Sayers, Peter Whimsey, Harriet Vane novel that you've done?
It is. It's actually the fourth Dorothy L. Sayers I've done with Lord Peter, but Harriet's just been in the last three.
Oh, right, right.
I have to say that Dorothy L. Sayers' novels are the only adaptations, only full-length plays I've adapted. And so by this time, I'm feeling pretty comfy with her and pretty confident. But in the beginning, it was really a Mount Everest. I adore her books.
Why don't you quickly just describe for people who might not know what these books are?
Well, Dorothy L. Sayers was a British mystery novelist in the 20s and 30s. And she was known for being kind of the intellectual's mystery writer. Her books are full of literary references and quotes. Her language is very, very highbrow and dense and, of course, glib and fun and hilarious and bubbly as well, enjoyable, but also, you know, dense and sometimes difficult.
She was an Oxford Don, is that right?
She was an Oxford graduate. She was one of the first women to receive a degree from Oxford University. And then she later did take up residence there as she pursued her more academic side of her career when she was done with Lord Peter Whimsey, which was right after Busman's Honeymoon. Right around 1937. She only wrote a few short stories after that in the mystery genre, and after that she would spend periodic little sabbaticals at Oxford, and she became a really well-known translator of works such as Dante's Inferno and The Song of Roland. And as a matter of fact, her Dante's Inferno and Purgatorio are thought to be one of the finest translations in academia.
So she's a pretty smart person.
Oh, yeah, she's a smart cookie.
Don't you call her a show-off?
Oh, she is a bit of a show-off, I think.
She likes to show off all the stuff she knows.
That's so true.
And how smart she is.
I often wonder if I would actually like her if I met her, because when self-described, she always says that she was like Lord Peter, constantly peppering her own speech with all of these very obscure literary references. And I'm sure that she always was the smartest person in the room, and I'm sure that everyone else in the room felt that as well.
Uh-huh. She made sure they did. Well, there are two interesting things about this adaptation. One is it's unusual to do three books in a series, so you get to return to the same characters over a very long period of time. And the other that I find fascinating is, as I understand it, she actually wrote this as a play, turned the play into a novel, and now you've turned the novel into a different play, I assume.
That's exactly the journey of the source material. So this one has broken all of the rules of the other Sayers novels. We did Whose Body in 2002, and that was her very first Lord Peter novel, and Peter Greenberg began his journey as Lord Peter then. And then a couple years later, we did Strong Poison when Harriet Vane enters the scene. And then in 2006, we did Gaudy Night, which really features Harriet as the detective almost. And now this one, the two of them are happily married and on their honeymoon and solving crime together. Mm-hmm. And as you say, this one began life as a play. Sayers always loved theater and the stage, giant fan, and she had a friend who was an experienced playwright, and they thought it would really be fun to see Lord Peter off on his final story in theatrical form. And so a play opened in 1935 in London's West End, Busman's Honeymoon, to mixed reviews, but I think it was very, very popular. You know, these were really beloved characters. And our first thought was maybe we would do that play. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd done three adaptations already, and this our fourth time out. It already was a play. Maybe we would do that. And I went to the Wade Center at Wheaton College, which has all of Dorothy L. Sayers' rare books and her correspondence and letters. And they have a copy of the play, and I read it. And although I enjoyed it so much, it was very much a product of its time. Mm-hmm. It was a very conventional play, all taking place in one drawing room. It had some, you know, fell into a bit of corniness here and there. So I felt that the novel, which came a year after the play, had so many wonderful scenes that did not take place in the living room, in the drawing room, that it would really be sad to do a play without all of those parts. Mm-hmm. Plus, I noticed that even scenes that were nearly word for word in the book and the play were a little bit different in the book. And since the play was a collaborative effort and the book is Sayers herself, I have to feel that in the book she had it the way she wanted it.
Well, and it was her second draft.
Yes.
So you got another crack at it.
So I just felt that it really was probably honoring her vision the most to do the book. And and it's been fantastic because we people are always startled to find out how much wouldn't have been in this play if we'd done the original version.
Right, right. Well, and what about, just before we bring in our two actors, what about the difference of doing three adaptations in a row from the same? What changes?
It's actually four.
Sorry, four. I keep
forgetting
that.
Three with Harriet, right.
Because it's the Peter and Harriet ones that I love the best.
So. Exactly, exactly. Me too.
Me too.
But what changes if you return to an author four times?
First of all, just the experience of learning that author. I mean, I just feel so comfortable. Mm-hmm. I no longer, you know, quake when I have to write in her voice because I feel comfortable in it. Mm-hmm. So there's that advantage, just comfort level and experience. Experience teaches you so much. With most projects, you look back and say, oh, if I only knew now what I knew
right.
then. And I get to do this several times knowing, you know, on building on the experience I've had before.
Well, let me interrupt you there and ask you, if you could now go back and, for instance, readapt Strong Poison, mm-hmm. are there things you would do differently?
Well, I have to say, I don't think so.
Well, good. Good for you.
I really love that one.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I think it would have been easier for me to adapt. I think I would have sweated less.
Right.
And it would have taken less time.
Mm-hmm. But you did find your way to the right
yes,
solution.
Yes, and I think it would have been easier on the actors because, you know, we had to work out a lot on our feet.
Mm-hmm, during rehearsal.
Right. Mm-hmm. That I probably would have been able to imagine and write earlier.
Mm-hmm.
but other advantages about doing a series... first of all, to be able to have the same actors in the series, I just can't even tell you. And I frankly told Peter and Jennifer each time around that I was not interested in continuing the series if I didn't have them.
Uh-huh, right. It'd be pretty hard to recast.
It would be a heartbreak for me. And I just know that I wouldn't emotionally be able to let go of just what I loved about what they bring
right.
to it. They're just absolutely unique. I know there are a lot of wonderful actors out there, but still the change might have been just too daunting for me.
Well, now, Jennifer and Peter, were you already members of the Lifeline Ensemble when you did this first play?
We were.
Yes.
Actually, if I remember correctly, the first novel that I read actually was Busman's Honeymoon, because Francis had brought the concept of a Sayers novel to the table, and we all at Lifeline, we all talk about what we're going to do, and
right.
we all read the books and so on. And I don't think you knew which one you wanted to do at
no,
first.
No, I didn't.
So we were involved in those discussions, and And then, of course, we decided to do Whose Body First and so on. Kind of the milestone novels, if you will.
Uh-huh. Well, I have to say, I think it's kind of amazing, actually, that you didn't, you know, do a citywide search for the perfect Harriet and the perfect Peter because you happen to already have them in your company. I think that's kind of wonderful.
It's completely fortunate. We're so lucky.
You know, it's a daunting thing to do. Most of what we do here at Lifeline is literature adaptations. And a lot of times the novels that we do are novels that are very well known.
Right.
Jane Eyre and so on.
And beloved.
Exactly.
That people care about. Right.
Exactly. And so that was, of course, one of my concerns when we first did Whose Body Is. I thought I could play the role. You know, I thought I could act the role. Mm-hmm. But I'm very different than the character as, I mean, physically
as described,
different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was a little daunting just in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, let's talk about the world that you're living in, because there are, I mean, I haven't read the play, but I'm not surprised to hear you say that there are things about it that are dated, and there are things in the novel that are dated. There are things about the culture that these characters live in, some of which we find off-putting. And so how do you deal with that when you are the sympathetic main characters of a play and you have some attitudes that you know your audience are going to be very distanced by?
I think one of the biggest things for me that has been kind of a running, it's almost a gag we talk about backstage a lot, is I, Peter Greenberg, am Jewish. And Dorothy Sayers was a product of her time and place. And she has interesting things to say about Jews in her mm-hmm. novels. They always seem to be the money grubbers,
right.
And so on. And she's a product of her time. And so most of the time, we, of course, simply excise those things from the play. And mm-hmm. we say, oh, well, that's the way things were. You know, Shakespeare himself was didn't have the most enlightened views on Jews. But one of the things that I think is a little inescapable of these plays is there is that the class difference.
Right.
Which, of course, is so huge, I think, much more so in Britain than it is here anyway. But the thing about at least playing Lord Peter is that one of the things I love about him is he is an absolute aristocrat, but he is so accepting. I think it's what makes him unusual, and in fact, what makes other aristocrats in the novels kind of look down on him.
Right,
is he tends to be.
He likes to slum it with the ex-cons, and.
Right. And I think I find that to be. As Peter Greenberg, I find that an admirable trait, and mm-hmm. it's one of the things I like to hook into.
Well, he studies human nature, and so that's right. every class.
Right.
You know,
right.
His whole point is to understand the motivations of people, mm-hmm. of all people. Mm-hmm. So you see him deal with everyone in his life kind of in a similar way.
Right.
The class structure is so inherently British
right.
that it would not be the same story without it.
Without it.
And I think that's the case in all plays and literature of the genre, British literature of
mm-hmm.
the genre.
Right, right, right.
What is the line that you have during the toast that every man should be?
Oh, it's a line that I've never thought of as being funny, but oftentimes the audience laughs at it. And I'm toasting Bunter, my manservant, and I say, and I kind of get a little choked up, and I say, any man is rich in friends who has a good wife and a good servant. And our audience, our American 2000 audience, laughs at that because they think it's a little silly, but Peter absolutely means it,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and the fact that I think just even having a servant is a little difficult for some of
right.
us to
I think that's right.
understand.
Yeah. Right.
But their relationship, their servant master relationship, is such a wonderful. They are absolutely servant and master, but it is not a normal servant.
There's not such a huge amount of respect
oh,
in
absolutely.
Those stations. Mm-hmm.
And I think in this play, one of the things I think Frances has done really nicely is she has pointed out those places where now it's three people trying to figure out
right.
how to have a relationship, right? Now that Harriet is actually part of the family, how is that going to work? And how are the three of them, how do they maneuver together? And I think those are some really wonderful little scenes in the play that you track, which
yeah.
is nice.
And not a dilemma that most of your audience has ever faced, but fun to watch. Well, how do you deal with what Frances called her kind of show-offiness? I mean, there is a lot of rather brittle almost affected sounding talk. And you as actors, I mean, it can be because they're just so highfalutin, you know, and when they start trading quotes with the vicar or whatever. How do you as actors deal with that?
Go ahead, Peter, because you have most of them.
Well, this is where Frances talked about learning over the course of Four Things.
Mm-hmm.
I've done the same thing, and I have to learn it every time, which is the less Peter appears to be trying to be funny, the funnier he is. And just technically, a lot of times, I know this sounds silly, but a lot of times it simply means talking as fast as I possibly can. Because you know, he'll have a paragraph where he's expressing one thought.
Right.
And in that thought, he's quoting the Bible twice, and Shakespeare once, and singing a little snippet of a song he just made up.
French.
And a lot of it is kind of finding an overall arc, which means kind of getting to the end of it. And the audience finds that charming and kind of frothy, whereas mm-hmm. the times when I am less successful doing that, where literally it just takes me longer to get through it, mm-hmm. the audience they have time to catch up, mm-hmm. and they think, I'm
come
not exactly
already.
Sure what you're saying.
Right.
And come on already.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, technically as an actor, some of it I have to sort of throw it away,
mm-hmm.
Act like it's unimportant, and that's tends to be what is the most effective way. But it's interesting. I have to relearn that every time. Mm-hmm. I go through this in rehearsal, and I labor on these lines, and we get into previews, and the audience stares at me with a blank stare when I say one of these lines, and I think, that's not working. And then I remember, oh, of course, I have to be more nimble. I have uh-huh. to get through it faster, and then it starts to work.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk about the love story a little bit, because I think Sayers herself talked about this as essentially a love story with a mystery structure underneath it. And it occurred to me as I was thinking about this interview that when you read the books, the relationship, you're very intimate. I mean, you're just, you know, it's just in your head, these two characters. And now suddenly on a stage, it's bigger and they're further and they're smaller. And I've suddenly thought that there is something rather antithetical about the stage to love scenes, you know, that the objectivity of theater makes it kind of hard, I would think, to create romance. And in this case, there's a little bit of sexiness, too. So I don't know if that's something you thought about or struggled with, or I'm just, you know, it's not actually a problem. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, this play is different in that regard, because they're consummating their relationship, finally, after how many years, Frances?
She's been putting him off for 5, but I think he's known her for it might be 7.
And so their courting has been this meeting of the minds, and you know, they both are incredibly intelligent and witty, and I think that that's how they've wooed each other, mm-hmm. is through that wit and never through touch. And so this is a very different thing, and it was actually something that Peter and I kind of had to figure out in this rehearsal process of mm-hmm. how do we bring these two characters who have sort of, you know, caressed each other with words previously.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're seeing them kind of lovey-dovey. And what is their version of lovey-dovey? You know,
uh-huh.
they're not sappy. They're not, you know,
right.
Certainly in a contemporary way, a hand-holdy kind of couple.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And trying to also extend the suspense of that and the pleasure of that consummation throughout the, you know, the 2-hour show. You know, you don't want to do too much of that.
We leave them in bed at the end of the first act, is that right? When do they end up in bed together?
It's kind of the end of the first big scene.
It's
about 20 minutes in.
Uh-huh, okay.
But that's one thing that's unique about this, is because most stories end with the boy getting the girl.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually what comes after Happily Ever After. So again, the Happily Ever After kind of happens 20 minutes in, but we all know in real life that that is not the end of the story, and there are so many more complicated layers to a relationship like that and roles to be negotiated. What I really love is that this play gets to explore some of that real life stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. I still think it's sweepingly romantic, mm-hmm. but it's romantic in a way that is real, that I think married people understand. They've had to go through that.
Well, doesn't Peter say something like that? He says, now I know we're married because I'm, was it the chimney sweep or something? They're dealing with real domestic trials.
She says that they've had to hire the chimney sweep because the chimneys are all blocked up. And she yells upstairs to him, Peter, the sweep is here. And he comes down and he's overjoyed to hear those words because he says, ah, now I know I'm actually married. Right. It's a wonderful thing.
Right, right.
But, you know, what I wanted to say, too, is that one of the things that helps, I think, us play the intimacy, you talked about intimacy and on stage, and mm-hmm. it's kind of antithetical. It's true. It helps that they're British because British intimacy, I mean, frankly, is just different.
Right.
Especially British 1930s aristocrat right. intimacy is different then. And so they don't want to be constantly, I mean, maybe they do want to in their heart of hearts. They want to be touching each other and so on, but they never would. Even when they're alone. In the very first scene, they're alone. Harriet approaches Peter, and Peter says, I don't want to kiss you right now. Uh-huh. Let's act like we're not married right now. Uh-huh. And it's only after a few minutes that he finally gets his courage, and they say, let's kiss. Mm-hmm. And so on stage, it's helpful because, right. as you say, it is a non-intimate atmosphere just by the medium.
That's very interesting.
It's true, and I also love that Peter is so used to playing the clown in all of these books that I don't think he has an easy time seeing himself as the leading man in his own story. Mm-hmm. And so when the moments where they do show affection, he doesn't use his own words. You know, first he has to speak French, you know, before he's quoting it in French. When we see them have affection, it's actually they need a bridge. They need to quote in French or to quote a love poem. And that actually becomes part of the character arc, that the relationship matures when they actually have the guts to be themselves and use their own words.
Mm-hmm. That would be so arch. Mm-hmm. Mm, that's interesting. Well, now here's kind of a punter's question, I guess. But I think non-actors are always fascinated by sexual behavior between actors. I mean, how do you kiss someone who isn't... And as I say, I know you're acting all the time and you're pretending to do all kinds of things, but there is something, I think, in you know the mind of someone who hasn't done it that seems like it's in a different category. Is that true or not? Is it at all weird to kiss someone who's another actor just because they're this character?
It can be. It is not in this case, but it definitely can be. I have certainly played love scenes, and I say love scenes, I mean kissing scenes.
Right,
I don't mean
right.
anything more than that. With actors that I don't get along with that well. Again, not
you
in this case.
You and I had one years ago, I remember.
Yes, that was terrible.
In my acting days. Thank God that's behind us.
I never heard about those.
We're getting to the good stuff now.
And it is hard because that action, of course, it is simply an action that you are performing on stage just in the same way you drink a cup of tea.
Right.
But it isn't like drinking a cup of tea. Physically, it isn't. I mean, I think when you kiss someone or when you caress someone, I think your body just, you can't help it. Your body affects your mind and,
right.
and vice versa.
Right.
And so sometimes it's easier and sometimes it's harder. In this case with Jennifer, it's easy.
I think you have to say why.
Because we're married.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Does the whole world know that and not me?
I don't think so necessarily. I mean, I think probably the acting community knows it.
Well, that is fascinating because one of the things that strikes me about the two of you in these roles is that you do have whatever chemistry is. I mean, we believe that you're attracted to each other. And I think part of maybe what underlay my question is, do you have to be attracted to someone to seem to be attracted to them? And that, I mean, that's what actors do, is you seem to be all kinds of things you're not. But I do wonder if there's certain things you can't quite fake. So that's really interesting to me. I mean, you know, the love scenes between you are sexy, I think, in this play. And that's very important to me because, you know, it's hard to have romantic love without that feeling.
Right, absolutely. It was something that I've never worried about, certainly, but, you know, I have thought about the fact that our relationship personally, you know, we've been married now for almost, about 4 years, and it's a very different energy, you know, an energy of a couple that have been together for several years.
Right.
It's very different than the sexual energy
right.
of a couple that is just getting together.
Your life is much more the chimney sweeps at this point,
right? That's right. That's
right.
And how do you use what you have, mm-hmm. but also kind of morph it a little bit to mm-hmm. make it appropriate for the play? I know that I've seen, I can't tell you who they are now, it slips my mind, but I know that I've seen either couples in film or whatever that I thought, you know, they shouldn't have done that play together because mm-hmm. I can tell that whatever that energy is, it's just not crisp anymore, you mm-hmm, know? Mm-hmm. And I just haven't felt that about us. I feel like it's something actually that I feel very confident about and I don't really have to think about mm-hmm. when we're on stage together and we are saying, you know, words of love and desire for each other. It's just very natural.
Right. Well, now I could imagine the other side of that is here you are sort of, I mean, working together with your life partner can be complicated.
I suppose there could be, again, for me, and certainly in our current situation, I can't think of any. Mm-hmm. The reality is, I think I'm like many Chicago actors. I don't make my living as an actor, and so I have a full-time job. Jennifer also has a job outside of the theater. Well, if one of us were doing a show and doing our jobs, we would literally pretty much never see each other.
Right.
And we are one of those couples that like each other. So we like to see each
other. That's always good in marriage, I think.
Yeah. And so to me, that is a big part of it, frankly,
right.
is
mm-hmm.
is doing the show together means we can actually spend time together.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Whereas if one of us, as I say, were in the show, that would be a hardship. So I don't know. Do you find there are?
I don't. I guess I could imagine that if we were doing a different type of play, or if it was if we were George and Martha or something, I don't, you know, that
something really dysfunctional might not be so great.
Yeah, that maybe that would be less idyllic. But I feel pretty lucky.
Well, one thing we haven't talked about at all, and I think we don't have a lot of time, but it does seem very interesting to talk about putting a mystery on stage. Mysteries are so technical to write. And I imagine that both in the adapting and in the playing, they present some special challenges. So maybe start quickly mm-hmm. with Frances and then a little bit from the actors, too.
Well, that is absolutely true. You've hit the nail on the head there. And that has been probably the major challenge with all the adaptations is simply trying to make the puzzle fit. You can't just cut pieces of the puzzle and have the puzzle come together. So most of the time it's kind of creating a new puzzle that includes the stuff that is important from the original puzzle. And I mean that as far as words, you know, and the adaptation and the scenes and the characters and making that all work so that the linear story of the clues work.
Right.
And there have been challenges physically in every show, you know, whose body we had to turn. We had to do some mercury test on stage with a chemical reaction every day. And, I mean, there have been little things in every single show. But I have to say this one in particular, I'll let Jen and Peter talk about it, but the having to actually show the method of murder on stage has been particularly a physical challenge. I'll say that... it was a surprise to me how difficult it would be to put a murder mystery on stage. Mm-hmm. And if I'd known 10 years ago, I probably never would have attempted it. But at this point, I just had to come to grips with the fact that I would have to actually do more original writing than I wanted to. Mm-hmm. It isn't simply a matter of editing the original. It's a matter of, well, the audience only has attention span to get to know 10 people, so I have to make the people who discover these clues, learn this information, or care about this information be these 10 people. Mm-hmm. So how do I create a story that makes those people the ones who are on the trail for the, you know, instead of having 50 characters, we have 10 and I'm going to make that work.
To redistribute information to new people.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And to cut locations as well. You cut characters, you cut locations, and you cut what clues you can, but you have to make it all line up again. So that's the puzzle.
So then how about in the acting? Are there things that are unique about doing mystery acting?
I think one of the things about acting in a mystery, at least a mystery that is adapted from a novel, is you have to, as the character, you have to be both smarter and dumber than that same character would be in the novel. Partially because of what Francis just said. In the novel, there are 50 people, and all of them are kind of the same thing. And as you're reading, you know, you as the reader don't, you know, you don't have any idea. And so the characters also, you know, there's, but on stage there are four.
Right. And the clues are buried in the novel,
right?
And they're exposed in the play
because it has to be so much more stripped down,
right? Yeah. And so as an actor, you can't think, well, it can only be four people. Who could, you know, right? You have to sort of have the same level of, no, it could be anybody,
right?
But at the same time, so you have to be kind of dumber in that
right.
way, but
right.
you have to be smarter too, because in the novel, you can have 15 clues, and you just don't have time for 15 clues
right.
on stage.
Right.
You have to have four.
So you have to make these big leaps.
Exactly. So the character has to be able to say, wait a minute, that means such and such. And that, to me, is an interesting thing to play. And it's also interesting for Peter, because Peter, of course, is a very smart guy, but what always happens is something serendipitous happens, or someone makes a discovery that to them means nothing, that Peter seizes on and says, hey, wait a minute. And so sometimes, as the actor, you have to make sure the audience sees that you have just heard something that means something to you, even though the audience doesn't know what it means to you.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the audience says, hey, that was just important, even though I don't know what.
Why?
I'm sure we'll find out later.
That,
to me, I think, is almost one of my biggest jobs in terms of the mystery, is making sure the audience knows that I'm understanding something, even if I'm not telling them what that is.
Right. So we see it land.
And also, in rehearsals, we as the characters, we observe things about the crime that later we say, oh, yeah, that I remember when that happened. I was looking over here and I saw blah, blah, blah. So we have to, as actors, say, okay, so later I'm going to say that I saw that. I'm going to say, oh, yes, I remember when he, you know, opened the window or whatever. So we have to make sure that in those first scenes, even though it's not written either in the stage directions or as actual lines, we have to make sure that as our characters, we have to be aware of that moment.
You can't have your back to the, to it, for instance, so that the predicate is laid.
But conversely, it's kind of what Peter said, being smarter and dumber at the same time. You can't, like, look at it and have a realization at that moment, because otherwise the audience would figure everything out in the first scene of the play.
You just have to see it.
I'll tell you a secret, though. That there is something that later on in the play I say that I saw, which actually I'm not looking at when it actually happens. And I'll tell you the reason why I'm not looking at it. It's because it coincides with a laugh line. And I'm not giving up that laugh.
I think we have to end there. Thank you very much. This was a lot of
fun.
Thank
you.
Thank you so much,
Anne.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Mote, bringing you the theater news for the week of June 8th, 2009. Cavalia, the spectacular equestrian odyssey, will make its Chicago debut beginning on Tuesday, July 14th. This multimedia extravaganza brings together a mix of horses, acrobats, aerialists, dancers, riders, and musicians celebrating the timeless bond between horses and humans. Cavalia can be seen under its towering white big top at Racine and Jackson. Founded by one of the co-founders of Cirque du Soleil, Cavalia has captivated audiences across North America and Europe and has been praised by the media and critics alike. It's performed on a 160-foot-wide stage, so the horses can gallop, of course. Large panoramic images are projected on a 210-foot-wide curved screen, while stunning special and lighting effects illuminate the action on the stage and in the air. all accompanied by live music. Tickets for the show are on sale right now. To find out how to get those tickets, click on over to Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Be sure to check out a new article by Talk Theater in Chicago's newest contributor, Benno Nelson. Benno focuses on some of the smaller and newer theater companies that make Chicago theater so great. This article is about Dog and Pony Theater Company, a company dedicated to Chicago premieres of new plays. It also includes an interview with artistic director Chrissy Vanderwalker. So be sure to check out the article and help support Benno. The Goodman Theater concludes its season with Jose Rivera's newest play, Boleros for the Disenchanted, a true love story inspired by Rivera's parents' courtship and migration from Puerto Rico to make a life together far from home, and the struggle to hold on to love in the face of life's unexpected challenges. The show makes its Chicago premiere, directed by Henry Godinez. It also received its world premiere last season at the Yale Repertory Theater, also directed by Godinez. Boleros for the Disenchanted will be performed in English in the Albert Theater starting on June 20th. For more information, click on over to theaterinchicago.com. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank our guests for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And I would also like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.